Yeah, indeed. Good afternoon to you too as well. Ian Hoke sitting in for Scoot on this lovely Friday afternoon, April 11th in the year of our Lord 2025. Man, I can't wait to get back out. This is spectacular weather. Really happy for everybody at French Quarter Festival that you're getting in to enjoy it under these beautiful blue skies. I myself am going to be out there tomorrow and Sunday. I'm going to eat some crawfish. I'm going to drink some Abita strawberry. And I'm going to take in some great free local music. Very excited about that. Of course, that's all happening tomorrow. Today on the show, we have a lot to talk about. We're going to start out, you heard me tell Newell, we're going to start out talking about conspiracy theories. And this is one of the instances where I'm not so much interested in talking about the news as I am interested in talking about the reasons behind the news, if that makes sense. The ideas behind the news, the reason that things are happening. And that's always an interesting approach to take. You can talk about what's happening. But I sometimes think it's easier and more fun to sit back and kind of think about why it's happening. So we'll talk to a professor of psychology at LSU, Colleen Sinclair, is an adjunct professor. Conspiracy theories are everywhere now, especially in the world of news and politics, but there's a lot of just bogus ideas and rumors out there that have nothing to do with politics, and we keep falling for them. Why? Why? At no time in the history of human civilization has it been so easy to acquire knowledge. And I won't say it's easy to separate fact from fiction, because there's a lot of people out there who are making that process difficult on purpose. But everything that it's ever been possible to know, it just keeps getting easier to know it. But we keep falling for these odd conspiracy theories, big and small. So we'll talk about some of those with Professor Sinclair at about 1:25. I saw this post on Reddit, on the New Orleans subreddit. Somebody wrecked their bike pretty badly on Wisner Boulevard. I guess they like blacked out while they were getting ready to go up over that bridge, and they ended up in the roadway, which I wasn't sure if that meant, like, did they fall off the overpass? Like, what the hell happened here? But I think they were getting ready to go up and cross over the overpass, you know, in the bike and pedestrian lane. But on their way up there, blacked out, the bike got screwed up somehow, and they ended up in the roadway. And the next thing they know, they're being loaded into an ambulance, and they're covered in blood, and there's strangers that are helping load them up. So they put this post up on Reddit just saying, hey, whoever you are, thank you. I don't really know how to contact you or give you your bloody shirt back, but just want to let you know I appreciate what you've done. And it got me thinking, I bet there's a lot of people listening today who have been in a similar sort of situation. And that could be any number of different situations, right, where, I don't know, it could be something very simple, like your car broke down or you got a flat tire and somebody showed up and helped you, took time out of their day. And they didn't do it because they wanted money or they wanted clout on social media. They just did it because it was the right thing to do. The Good Samaritan. Have you ever been in a situation where a total stranger helped you out or maybe even saved your life? On the other side of the coin, have you ever been that good Samaritan and helped out somebody who needed it, even though you knew you'd never get the credit? There would be no financial reward for this. I really want to talk to you about that. I think that'll be a good, uplifting, fun, you know, faith in humanity restoring conversation to have on this lovely Friday afternoon. In the 3 o'clock hour, we're going to lighten it up big time and talk about crawfish, the fourth annual crawfish cook-off at the University of Holy Cross in Algiers is happening tomorrow. You don't want to miss this. I've been before. It's a great time. We'll get you all the details from university spokesperson Blaine Braddock. That's coming up at 3:25. It is too late to enter to compete in the crawfish cook-off, but it is not too late to get tickets. And you go and eat as much crawfish as you want. I think I'll double check with that about Blaine, but there is no limit to how much crawfish you can eat. I think it's all you can eat. And there's judges, and they decide who has the best crawfish, et cetera, et cetera. Before we get too much further, I do want to remind you, you can get tickets to Jazz Fest free from us, from WWL. on our website, we got this contest page where all the contests go. And the only contest we're running right now is a Jazz Fest ticket giveaway. If you go to WWL.com/contests, you can enter to win a pair of tickets to the first weekend of Jazz Fest, where you can see Santana, Lil Wayne is playing with The Roots, which I'm incredibly excited about. I didn't know that was happening. I love The Roots, and I'm curious to see what their collab with Lil Wayne is like. Lenny Kravitz will be there, John Fogerty, Dave Matthews, Luke Combs, Pearl Jam, still alive. That's all happening the first weekend of Jazz Fest. We really want to send you there. On Thursday, I was able to successfully enter the Jazz Fest contest in 35 seconds. Yesterday, I think I did it in about 25 seconds. Maybe a little bit later, we'll see if I can even make it even faster. Because if I can do it that fast, you can too. All you got to do is go to WWL.com/contests. You can do that on your phone or on your desktop or laptop computer. And just think about it. In less than 30 seconds, you can enter to win a free pair of tickets. Like, what do you got to lose? Are there other people competing for the same tickets? Yes, but it cost you nothing but 30 seconds to enter the contest. Just go do it, man. Also excited about this, tomorrow at Bantig's Nursery on the North Shore, you can go meet Dan Gill, who's the host of The Garden Show here on WWL on Saturday mornings. He's going to be at Bantig's in Lacombe. They got the largest selection of plants in southeast Louisiana. You may enjoy going out there and picking up some new house plants. Maybe you want to plant a tree or two, or you got some flowers you want to be planting. Go see Bantig's. Go see Dan Gill out there. Stop by, say hi. He's going to be at Bantig's on Highway 190 in Lacombe tomorrow from 9 to 11 a.m. I see a couple people stacking up on hold to talk to me about their Good Samaritan stories already. Great. Stay there. I'm going to try and get to you as fast as I can, but I got to say hi to my guy Coleman first. Good afternoon to you too as well.
Hey, how you doing, Ian?
I'm great. You like crawfish, right?
Yes, I love crawfish.
Okay, so the crawfish cook-off, let me ask you this, I guess. Like, what if price isn't an object, how many pounds of crawfish you think you can eat in one sitting?
Probably around 4 or 5.
That's about usually what I do. Yeah,
yeah, about 4 or 5.
I think the most I've ever had is 5. Do you have a fixin's preference?
Potatoes and sausage.
Yeah, I like the sausage. I always get the sausage.
And the corn, too.
Yeah. I was at a crawfish boil not that long ago where they had, I had ravioli last year. Some people are putting ramen noodles in there now.
Okay.
I like the little mushrooms. It's hard for me to get fired up about crawfish boiled potatoes.
Really? No, I love them.
Yeah, I just like
the
Zataran
season is like the Tony Satcheries. It's all of that involved.
I guess are you seasoning the potato like after
yes,
you?
Yes, the corn. I use Tony Satcheries on damn near everything. Everything I eat got tested, even beyond seafood and crawfish. Like
okay.
Or if you give me Applejacks, I might put Tony Satcheries.
Don't put Satcheries on that. Well, now that I'm thinking about it,
you never know.
I like Applejacks. I like Tony Satcheries. Put them together. It's like you got chocolate in my peanut butter. You got peanut butter in my chocolate.
Hey, just between us guys.
Yeah.
What do you think 5 pounds of crawfish actually equates to when you eliminate like the shells and like the actual crawfish meat? What do you think that boils down to?
I'd gotta say half a pound.
Okay. Well, maybe I could eat 2 pounds of crawfish meat.
Yeah. You know? If they're already shelled and squeezed and all that.
Yeah.
Could you eat like five pounds of just already shelled crawfish?
I probably couldn't.
That actually sounds kind of whack. That's not appetizing.
But I can't eat a whole large pizza for some reason, though.
No. Yeah. Well, I had a 20-ounce steak and 5 chicken wings last night for dinner, and let me tell you, it was pretty full. Let's go to Steve on the Lakeshore. Steve, good afternoon. You're on WWL.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Loud
or do
and
I
clear.
Need to turn off my radio?
Nah, we got you. Five, man. Go ahead.
I've been on both sides of it, and when I heard you mention Wisner just a few months ago, I was on my bike at Wisner and Allen Toussaint,
mm-hmm.
and somebody ran a red light, hit me at about 30 miles an hour, ended up with a... with my head split open, with some broken ribs and a lot of bruises, found myself face down on Allen Toussaint and Wisner, but I heard a man's voice, and it wasn't the driver of the car. It was just some man who said he had a medical background, and I could see a pool of blood under my face, so I knew there was something going on, yeah. And luckily... he was able to put pressure on my head somehow to curtail the bleeding. He called the police and the fire department, who were only a block or so away. They got me into an ambulance in about 5 minutes and ended up stapling my head and stabilizing me. But I don't know where I would have been if it hadn't been for that guy, who I don't know who he is. And there was actually a crime camera on that corner that the police looked at and told me about after the fact, and told me if I had been going about 1 second faster on my bike, or if the car had been going 1 second slower, they would have hit me right on the hip and the knees. They said I would have either been dead or crippled for life. So I was very lucky in that regard. No, and on the other hand, I had the occasion to actually save somebody. I was riding my bike in City Park last summer, and it was like 100 degrees at noon. And every time I went around the park, I kept seeing the same girl who was about in her 20s, but she was substantially overweight and wearing a really tight black spandex outfit, and she wasn't carrying any water.
Uh-oh.
And I couldn't believe that she was walking in that heat. Well, fast forward, I don't know, 20 minutes later, some woman sees me on my bike and grabs me and tells me about a woman who is passing out and going into dehydration shock. Can I help? So she led me to where the woman was. The woman was screaming, crying, could barely breathe or talk. I was afraid she was going to have a heart attack.
Yeah.
I saw two bikers coming towards me with water, got them to stop. We poured water all over the girl to try and at least calm her down. Mm-hmm. Then another guy came to see if he could help. And to make a long story short, we found out that this girl had parked her car at the Children's Museum. So the guy that just came along, we gave him the car keys. He went and got her car, back.
Wow.
We turned on her air conditioning. The three of us picked her up because she was pretty heavy. Picked her up, put her in the car to get the AC going so she wouldn't have a heart attack. Then when we were finally able to get her to speak and stop crying, she told us that she was local, that her parents were in town. We called her parents. Her parents were able to come over and take care of her.
Good, good.
And, you know, I don't know any of the people's names. I've never seen her since. There's no question that woman would have either died or been much worse off if all these people didn't come around and help. So it really, I wouldn't say it restored my faith in people, but just reaffirmed my faith in people that they will help when they have the opportunity to do so.
I love it. Steve, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm so glad that you were able to come away from your bike accident and that you were able, along with those other fellas, to help that woman. Yeah, man, people, you gotta be hydrating out there. And if you're wearing something that's tight and black and not breathable, you really better be drinking some water. We're going to step away here and come back. I know Daniel, Mark, and William are on hold, and they also want to tell us their stories. Guys, if you can ask you to just hang on through this interview, I'll try and get to you as fast as I can on the other side. Thank you for your patience in advance. If you want to get in touch, the number is 504-260-1870. That's the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text line. I'll read 100% of the texts you send today. I'll reply to as many as I can, and the best ones I'll read on the air. Make them count. When we come back, we'll be speaking to Colleen Sinclair, an adjunct professor in the psychology department at LSU. Ian Hoken for Scoot. I'll be right back after this. Here's the Pixies. We're going to spend a few moments today talking about not specific conspiracy theories, but the factors behind them, the reason that they make us all go wild and laugh and shake our heads, but also sometimes they create problems in the real world, leading us into disinformation spaces that encourage us to adopt the worst possible explanation for routine everyday events. And then even sometimes they drive a wedge between ourselves and our friends and loved ones, or even worse, they lead to violent or destructive acts. And I'm not even talking about the granddaddy conspiracy theories, you know, about JFK is coming back from the dead to meet his QAnon friends at Dealey Plaza, or the Comet Pizza in Washington, D.C. is actually the headquarters of a global sex trafficking operation, or the 2020 election was being stolen by little old ladies in Atlanta who are actually just sharing butterscotch candies with each other. You may recall during the 1980s, the McMartin preschool trial in Manhattan Beach, California. This became the best known example of what we now call satanic panic. Allegations surfaced that teachers at the preschool were involved in satanic rituals and widespread child abuse. Parents accused teachers and staff members of subjecting children to bizarre rituals involving animal sacrifices, secret tunnels underneath the school, and sexual abuse. The trial, as a result, became the longest and most expensive criminal trial in American history at that time, stretching over several years. But despite extensive media coverage and sensational claims, most of those charges were dropped or resulted in acquittals. This case highlights the dangers of this type of moral panic and the power of conspiracy theories to influence public opinions and even legal proceedings. Of course, concerned parents aren't the only ones who can fall for conspiracy theories. Elder millennials like me and anyone who is in middle or elementary school in the mid to late 1990s knows all about Marilyn Manson and why he got his ribs removed. If you know, you know. Even just this week, after the tragic killing of 17-year-old Austin Metcalf at a North Texas high school track meet, the story has snowballed into something that's bigger than just that murder. And it's become more about the conspiracy theories and misinformation spreading, including a social media account impersonating that town's police chief, falsified autopsy reports, and more. There is now an FBI investigation here, and almost certainly more people than just that murderer are going to face criminal charges for some of this stuff. So we're going to get into these strange corners of the human psyche with our guest, Colleen Sinclair, who's a psychologist and associate professor of research at the Social Research and Evaluation Center at LSU. Professor, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I realize I've got two different titles for you here. I've got adjunct professor in psychology, but also associate professor. Which is it, please?
I actually have multiple titles. I'm affiliated with both the College of Education and the Department of Psychology, but my primary position is Associate Professor of Research with Shrek.
Great. I'm going to call you Professor Sinclair. How's that?
That works for me.
I'm so pleased to hear it. What defines a conspiracy theory, and why do people find them so compelling?
Okay, well, those are two questions. So let's tackle the first one. So what is a conspiracy theory? So first, it's important to like differentiate between a conspiracy and a conspiracy theory. So a conspiracy, you know, it's just a belief that two or more actors have coordinated in secret to achieve some sort of outcome. And so like if your friends are plotting to throw you a surprise party, that's a conspiracy, right?
That's a great conspiracy. I love it. Yeah.
Okay, so, but a conspiracy theory adds a couple of levels to that. One, they would argue that this plot is of public interest, but not of public knowledge. Like, the public should know about it. Two, they usually involve that the public, if they don't find out about it, could be potentially affected, often harmed, if it goes unnoticed or uncorrected. Third, it usually also adds that it's an opposition to a publicly accepted explanation for an event or circumstance. Mm-hmm. Four, it's often socially shared, and that it's something that gets communicated about a whole bunch of people, and therefore has the potential to create like new social realities and to shape cultures and group actions. So, and that way it's also number five, it's what we call a risky belief, that it's more prone to falsification and lacking evidence than other types of beliefs.
Wow. I love that when we get a really fleshed out definition for a word or a phrase that gets used a lot, and we don't really have a common understanding of what that means. So thank you for that. My sort of secret second question there, why do people find these so compelling? Why do people go in for this stuff?
There are a lot of different reasons. One of the primary explanations is a theory by Karen Douglas, where she says that largely people are attracted to conspiracy theories because they're basic psychological motives that are not being met. Like they have a need for control, or they have a need for understanding, or they have a need for positive self-esteem, or they even have a need for belonging, and endorsing this belief helps them form a relationship with somebody. So these basic psychological needs are being unmet somehow. Like if there's a natural disaster, you feel not safe. And so you have a need for security, and you don't have enough information about why that event occurred, especially the larger the event, the more it creates a need for explanation. And the more it's a dread risk event, like something that's a potential threat to your life and well-being, the more we need explanation. And so these are things that then in the environment motivate people to find answers when often, especially for occurring, newly occurring events, we don't have that information yet.
I see. So if people are trying to exercise control or feel like they have control over their own lives, and they're reaching for these, you know, implausible explanation for things that are happening to them and happening in their communities and the world, you know, they should right. they should turn to something else. I don't know, like do a puzzle, you know, build a birdhouse or something. I don't, you know, it's like what how do you sort of draw people away from wanting to do that?
From being drawn to conspiracy theories? That's a big question. That's the question of the ages.
Yeah.
Especially how you can get people out once they've fallen in. That's a really hard question to address, and we don't have all the answers there yet, because this is how you can convince anybody with any sort of extreme belief, potentially especially a belief that is tied to their self-concept and part of how they view themselves. Then it's really hard to debunk or to get people to see the light, I suppose.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we used to talk about getting people out of cults, right? And there are all these ideas that, oh, you got to abduct somebody and de-brainwash them. Well, there's not really any actual research about how that happens. We know that people leave cults. We know that people reject conspiracy beliefs, but we do not yet have enough understanding about how to get them out. As far as preventing people from getting in, well, one of the things that we want to do is sort of educate people about, you know, these are the conditions that might make you fall for it, right? And here are the manipulative techniques that conspiracists use to get people to pick up their conspiracy theories. So we try and arm people with information to prevent them from falling in, like telling them, you know, okay, this is a pandemic. We don't know a lot about it yet. Wait, we're finding out as we go. Don't fall for, you know, what you hear on social media.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got me thinking about, there must be a cottage industry out there somewhere of, like, you know, deprogramming people that are in cults or that believe in conspiracy theories. It's like, hey, come on over. We're all going to, you know, build birdhouses together. But at the same time, there's going to be a lecture that explains, like, here's why the Rothschilds aren't, you know, programming your children for whatever conspiracy reason they have. Look, I think about this all the time as somebody that's in the media. What is there sort of a playbook for how to effectively debunk conspiracy theories without at the same time reinforcing them? It's like, if you talk about something that's a conspiracy theory and you're trying to shed light on it and show people, like, hey, man, that's not true. That's not what's happening. How do you do that with also not signal boosting it at the same time and maybe, you know, unintentionally getting other people to buy into it while you're distracted trying to get somebody else to buy out of it?
Right. So a couple things there. One, the thing that you're talking about is sort of the backfire effect. And actually, research hasn't found a lot of evidence for the backfire effect that confronting, like, whether it's disinformation or a conspiracy theory, makes it stronger. Mm-hmm. So just to put that out there, people shouldn't be afraid of debunking things, right?
Yeah.
And so we haven't really, there. People argue that that might happen, but there hasn't been any actual empirical support for it happening. It's really an elusive effect. And so go out there, debunk. But the, you know, some of the things that you want to be careful about is that you want to address the belief and the underlying motives for why they have that belief and what is their evidence for that belief. You don't want to attack the person. So all of us likely believe some sort of conspiracy theory or another. The endorsement of conspiracy theories is far-ranging. And some conspiracy theories about conspiracies turned out to be true, right? So it was, in fact, true that, you know, the tobacco companies were hiding evidence of the harms of tobacco causing cancer in order to raise profits. That's a true thing. You know, it was a conspiracy that led to the, you know, assassination of the Duke Franz Ferdinand. You know, that was a Serbian plot by the Black Hand Group. So there are examples of conspiracies. So we don't want to just, like, attack people that you're a crazy conspiracist, right? And so what we should do is be open to having conversations. And so start asking questions about why they believe what they do. What's the evidence that they have? Where are they finding out this information? So ask questions, and be open to hearing, you know, and understanding what their perspective is so that you are not attacking them, right?
Yeah.
And so now I'm not saying that this always works, but this is one of the things that you hear about anybody who comes out of an extremist group, that it was often that people were willing to sit down and have the conversations with them. It's, you know, requires patience. It's not deprogramming. It's about building a relationship and trying to understand the underlying reasons for the beliefs that they have.
In your work, have you ever seen that process play out in a way that's not fruitful? This happens on this program a lot where, I try not to call people crazy or stupid. I'll often kind of couch it and say, you know, I don't know if this is a stupid person, but this is a stupid comment, or maybe that's not helpful. Or, you know, I do try to get people to explain where they're coming from. And maybe it's just the virtue of the fact that we're doing this largely over text messages or in a talk radio environment where we're kind of yoked to the clock and we're not sitting in the same room with one another. People, in my experience, people are not responsive to that. Broadly speaking, most part, they are. If you ask them to explain why they believe something or what they think about it, they change the subject or they attack you for asking them. What do you do with that?
I haven't had somebody attack me for asking them.
I'll trade you jobs in a heartbeat, Professor. If I can come and do what you do and not get attacked for asking those questions, you can come up here and do this. I'd love it. I'm only kidding.
It might be in part a product of different settings. So, yes, you are in a public setting, right?
Yeah.
And so that's part of why sometimes, like, having these conversations on a public forum, like on a social media post, cannot be productive. People will immediately feel under attack and feel like they need to defend themselves because it's about saving face. It's in a public forum. And so, you know, that's already putting people in a state of self-consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So their ability to separate themselves from their beliefs is going to be a lot harder in a public context. And so, and I never say you should never have a conflict over text messaging. I tell my kids that all the time.
Boy, God, tell me. So, oh, man.
So, yeah, face-to-face is better.
Oh, gosh. Okay, just a few minutes left here, Professor. If you had to give advice to, I don't know, let's say people in the media, institutions, public figures, who are, you know, and you see it in polling all the time, like there's falling faith in mass media, all sorts of institutions, academia, the courts, et cetera, et cetera. How do institutions start to rebuild trust in factual information and at the same time reduce the allure of conspiracy theories? I suspect that's another billion-dollar question, but your thoughts?
Right, it is. And there is dedicated researchers who are committed to that, increasing science communication. And I'm one of the people who's committed to it, because part of it is that we need to counter the information that's out there. Like, whenever the infodemic came out, that was when I was like, back in the day, I was like, I'm never going to blog. But then I started blogging because I was like, I need to get legitimate information out there. Which does show that, you know, when people can get access to the truth, then they will be more likely to endorse it, to understand, to see where things are coming from. People do like having evidence for their beliefs. And so, yes, there is increasing backlash because, well, we probably don't want to get into it. We have a more conspiratorial administration.
Truly.
And it is increasing attacks. Like, I have had death threats. My colleagues have had death threats, literal attacks against the science community, where all news that they don't like is fake news. You know, like, so we've got, and that is a product, unfortunately, of the environment that we're currently living in. Not that we haven't had instances where government institutions or science has let us down or led us astray, but the methods that are applied and used in investigative journalism or in scientific methods is far better than what you're going to get with some dude who thinks that he knows everything because of his, I don't know, personal experiences selling essential oils and sets up a website about it. And so, you know, people, because we continue to have a need for understanding and we're being told again and again by certain influential people that we can't trust the traditional sources of that information, we still have the need for understanding. So it makes us then actually more dependent on unreliable sources.
Hopefully this too shall pass, Professor. We have to stop there, but thanks so much for being a part of the show today. I think we're all a little bit wiser for it. Thanks for your time, your work, and your way. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Professor Colleen Sinclair from the psychology, education, all sorts of departments over at LSU. When we come back, I'll be taking some phone calls. I see Mark and William and Elmore, and we'll get a couple more in there before we ship off to the local news at 2 o'clock. And then at 2:10, we'll do national and international headlines in the 2:10 News Bomb. Shoot me a text. Give me a call, 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talking Text Line. I'm Ian Hoken for Scoot. I'll be right back. LSU baseball takes on the Auburn Tigers today. First pitch is at 6 o'clock. Tomorrow also 6 o'clock. Sunday at 2. Go Tigers! Let's get back to the Oakland Art Jewelers Talking Text Line, where we're going to find Mark in Ponchatoula. Mark, you're on the air. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. Ian, I think you do a great job. You fill in well for Skip.
Thank you, bud. Scoot. Appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm a retired nurse, nice. And I work most of my life with cardiac patients. Mm-hmm. About 40 years ago, we were in, I'm originally from Shreveport. My wife and I were up there. It was for Thanksgiving, and it was the day after Christmas, Black Friday, and we were walking through a mall, a very, very crowded mall, and there was an elderly gentleman with his wife in front of us about 10 feet, and he suddenly collapsed and went to the floor. Oh. And so, of course, my wife looked at me, I looked at her, and she took his wife to the side and sat down with her, so I immediately started CPR with the gentleman, and you lose sense of time, you know. I don't know how long it was before the EMTs got there, but it was probably about 20 minutes, and it's very exhausting to do that. So when the EMTs got there, they took over, and, you know, they put him in the ambulance, and they left. And so my wife and I just kind of, you know, wondered, you know, how he was doing. Mm-hmm. We never found out, so he came home. Well, about a week, about 10 days later, my mom sent me, the Shreveport Times has this place in the editorial section called Call the Times. And it was the gentleman's wife who called and said, "I just want to thank the two people nice. Who helped save my husband's life, you know, a few weeks, about 10 days ago." And it just really, you know, it was a good feeling that, you know, that she bothered to do that. You know, like I said, I never met him, but just knowing that he survived was nice. The crazy thing was, back in August of the same year, a few months earlier, the same thing happened on the beach in Florida. We got to the guy, and he just worked on it. We worked on him too. It was somebody else with me, and the EMTs got there, but he didn't make it, you know. But
yeah,
and so you wonder, you always wonder, you know, how come it worked on the gentleman in the mall and it didn't work on the beach, and you beat yourself up thinking, what did I do wrong? What did I do right? You know, but the fact is you just can't save everybody that you try to resuscitate. But, anyway, that's my Good Samaritan story.
I'm so thankful you shared it with us, and I love nurses. Yeah. I'm so thankful. That's God's work. Truly, man. Thank you for all you've done. And, thanks for listening and being a part of the show today.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Happy Easter.
And to you as well, Mark. Stay tuned. Let's get in William, who's in Mandeville. William, good afternoon. You're on WWL.
Yes, howdy. It was a Saturday afternoon, and I was in my apartment looking forward to a relaxed, quiet rest of the day. Mm-hmm. And I hear this hard knock on the door, And I said, I'm not answering that. And I said, no, that sounded really intense. So I opened the door, and it's a 12-year-old boy from the apartment next to me. He's got his dog next to him. And I see there's smoke coming out of his apartment. And he says, our apartment's on fire. Oh. I said, is anybody else in there? He said, no. I said, did you call the fire department? He said, yes. So I looked down. I grabbed my fire extinguisher that I bought for my car the night before but hadn't put it in the car yet.
No
I go kidding. In there. Yeah. I go in there. I put out the fire that's on the stove. And then I see it reignite.
Uh-oh.
I'm like, that's odd. So I run back out. I get my breath. I run back in, and I notice that the smoke is really accumulating on the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that things are starting to be like charcoal from the heat. I put it out, and it lights up again. And then I realize, oh, Billy, it's an electric stove. So I get some breath, run back in, click everything off, and then put it out for the final time, and it stays out.
Wow.
And then I asked him, the young boy, I said, do you mind if I take a picture on my phone? He says, no, it's fine. So then I jumped in the shower. I kept it real hot so I could expel the smoke and the ash.
Smart, yeah.
And then I went to Hooters and shared the picture of the fire on my phone. And I was very popular with the waitresses. And I ended up having a very nice evening.
I bet. I hope you got some free chicken wings out of that, Billy. That's great. That's a good story, man. And thank you for helping out that little boy. It's very brave of you to go in there and fight that fire a couple times, especially, you know, after you see the start really accumulating and stuff starting to char, you know, that's when it can kind of flash over and really get out of control, right?
Right. That was a concern. And his family was very gracious. Other tenants were very gracious the next day and thanked me. And I responded, if my family was there and I wasn't, I know y'all would have done the same thing.
Yeah. William, Billy, thank you so much for being a part of the show today and sharing that story. Great to talk to you, man. Have a great weekend. I'll pick up Elmore after the news, who wants to talk to me about conspiracy theories. I got room for more. We'll do the news bomb, but it's kind of a shorter one today. And then I don't have another scheduled interview until 3:25. I would love to spend that time talking to you. Yes, you. Ian Hoken for Scoot. We'll be right back after this. Stick around. Just remembering after William and Mandeville's story there, you should have smoke alarms in your house. If you're a landlord, your tenants should have smoke alarms in their house. I don't know about places on the North Shore or West Bank and beyond, but in Orleans Parish, you can get smoke alarms installed for free. You call 311 and they'll come to your house eventually and stick up a couple smoke alarms for you. I know that works because I did it. You should also have a fire extinguisher in your house, and your kids should know how to use it. That's just good, solid advice. There is a text here that says, hey, Ian, the Old Town Crawfish Fest is this Sunday in Slidell. Crawfish sales at Heidelberg's benefit Sergeant Candy's family. So that's a great cause. So get out to Heidelberg's and jump in on some of those crawfish and send that money to a good cause. We'll get caught up with the news with Chris Miller. We'll talk to Elmore in New Orleans East about conspiracy theories, and then we'll do the news bomb. Get in line right now so I can talk to you about your conspiracy theories and your Good Samaritan stories. 504-260-1870. Ian Hoken for Scoot. BRB.